my friends. This is Carter, and welcome to this episode of Making It Up, the conversation series where I get a chance to sit down with other writers and just learn about them, pick their brains a little bit, ask them why they chose to become writers, try to figure out their origin story, and talk about all the trials and tribulations of writing. So this intro is going to be a little bit longer because you know what? I've got some shit to talk about, and I'm not going to be plugging my stuff. Unless you want to go to carterwilson.com or unboundwriter.com and see all the things that I do. There. That is the end of my plugs. So today on the show, I had Tim Booth. Tim Booth is the lead singer and personal hero of mine, lead singer of the band James. So James has been around since the 80s, and he's been the front person of James for over 40 years, and James collectively has sold more than 25 million albums worldwide. So, you know, not a small thing. My relationship with James is, I'm going to explain it now so you have some context as to how I came to talk to Tim Booth. You know, I was aware of James. I knew their music growing up in Los Angeles. I listened to, that was in the 80s. That was called New Wave at the time, alternative 80s rock. I was listening to KROQ. So I knew James's larger hits that kind of floated across the Atlantic Ocean from the UK to the US. But not a lot of people were playing James. But I was aware of them. But it wasn't until decades later that probably about 17 years ago, my friend Lydia saw that James was coming to play in Denver. And so she suggested that we go to the concert. And so I said, sure, I remember James. I like James. Let's go check him out. And then she bailed at the last second. She had something else come up. And so I had to make this decision. Do I really want to go to this concert alone, drive all the way down to Denver? And they're like, fuck it. So I did it. And I went and I saw James perform live, again, Tim Booth being the front person of the band. And it was transformative. It really blew me away. And I just became immediately obsessed with this band. So I've seen them probably perform more than any other band that I've ever seen. I flew from Denver to Dublin, Ireland, alone to go see them perform. So I don't know if I'm going to use the word obsessive, but I really got into the band and their lyrics, obviously their music. And then I think starting with my fifth book, Mr. Tinder's Girl, I reached out to Tim. I was somehow able to get his email. I reached out to him for permission to use some of their lyrics in my book. And he was very kind and gracious and allowed me to do that. And I probably have done that maybe for five or six novels over the years. So the only time I've ever used lyrics in my books have been from the band James. And so we've gotten to know each other a little bit. Not very well. He was very kind to bring Jessica and I backstage to a concert that they had here in Denver, and we got to hang out with them. I also got the chance to take him out to dinner when he was in town for that particular concert. So, but again, I don't know him all that well, but I've always had so much respect for them and for the band and for his lyrics. And then he told me, I remember at this dinner we had together, he told me he'd been working on this novel and he'd been working on it for quite some time. And so we discussed that a little bit. And just recently, he kind of reached out. I saw that his novel was finished and that it's due to come out from Little Brown. And just so you know, the name of the novel is When I Died for the First Time. And we arranged for him to come on Making It Up to talk about his novel. So it was a book that was over 10 years in the making, certainly 10 years in the actual writing of. And so we got to sit down and kind of dissect that. So of course I'm nervous right before this fucking interview because it's Tim Booth. And I want to ask him about his writing journey. but I'm also a fanboy. So, you know, it was one of the few times I actually wrote some questions down ahead of time. Usually I don't write any questions down and we just have a free-flowing conversation. And I don't even know if I got to those questions, but I wanted to have a backup in case I turned into a blubbering idiot, which I probably did during a few times in this interview. But so he's written this book, When I Died for the First Time, and I just got kind of the final proof just a few days earlier before the interview. So I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing, but I read a chunk of it. And as I offered him effusive praise during the interview, I will do that now. It's a great, what I've read so far is fantastic. The writing is wonderful. It's instantly captivating. And it follows, I don't want to get into it too much, but it follows the lead singer of a band. And he's sober. The lead singer is sober. The rest of the band, not so much. And it's written, it's really interesting. It's written from the point of view as if it were fact and that the lead singer, something happened to the lead singer, and Tim Booth himself inherited this manuscript and kind of put it out to the world. So almost kind of like a Princess Bride type of conceit, which I think is very clever. So it is going to be coming out May 16th in the UK and a little bit later in the US. But we had a fantastic time talking. It was a thrill for me because, you know, this is my musical hero and my favorite band, and to be able to just sit down and interview the lead singer of your favorite band about the novel that they wrote is pretty fucking cool. I have to say. So that's it, folks. I think you're going to like, and I know you're going to like this one because this is a great one. This is my interview with Tim Booth.
I'm a perfectionist.
That's not a bad thing to be. That's why it took your book a long time, right?
Yeah. And it's why the people at the book company probably hate me. Because I just, every time they sent me some proof edit to read just for the punctuation, I would take it apart and start and re-edit the whole book, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was like, well, you're giving me this to read again. I'm going to start seeing the flaws and want to redo it.
See, I'm exactly the opposite. When I get my copy edits and things like that, multiple rounds of edits, I only look at the comments that they have because I know I'll get into that same trap of all wanted. Like, oh, this could have been so much better. And when I teach writing, when I coach it, I coach about not being perfect. Like, don't strive for that because you won't be that. And you're going to get trapped in this web of constantly revising until it gets to the point where it's kind of diluted. But it's different for everybody.
I definitely improved it every time I went back to it. And because I've got so much experience for that in songwriting. And right. For me, editing is everything. Like, right. It's the key. Yeah.
Right. Right. I think it's important to get that first draft out, though, to let it organically flow from you, whether it's a song or whether it's a book, whatever it is. So it's there because that's the hard part. Right. But I agree. The magic comes alive in the editing because then it's fun. Then it's like that challenge of like, how can I make every sentence better by still being true to the manuscript?
You mean you have fun? While you're writing.
It's taken me 22 years to figure out how to have fun while writing. And it mostly comes from not knowing what I'm writing about because I don't outline. So every day I'm like excited. I'm like, what happens next? That, you know, I'm excited to find out. But I want to go back a little bit. A lot of these interviews, you know, it's just about the journey of the writer. And I'm curious to know, and we'll spend just not very much time talking about James, but that's important as a lyricist to understand kind of the roots of your creativity. But just as a kid, I'm curious to know, were you the creative kid? Were you the one making up stories and telling your parents and your friends? Or were you... did you find yourself being a very normal, average kid?
I was brought up in a very average, normal household with not much culture. Mm-hmm. I think my sister had a record player, but my parents didn't. Not much music, not much anything, really.
No so reading?
Yeah, I did like books. I got into King Arthur's Grail stories probably young, six or seven. And I remember I used to sleep with books down my bed. I liked the feel of books on my feet. And I used to put loads of books. People used to sit in my bed and then jump up. And there'll be like 8, 9 books down there. Like
hard. So it was like a tactile thing almost.
It was a tactile thing. They were my favorite books and I would sleep with them. It's kind of my attitude to most things I love, is if you love them, you should sleep with them. I used to sleep with books down my bed. The first time I probably ever told anybody this fact. And it was myths that I got into, Beowulf and and the Greek myths. My father was into them, I think, from school, and so he fed me them. And those are the first stories that I loved. I didn't write myself very much. Yeah. There wasn't much outlet for creativity. But I had a big breakthrough. I think I was probably 12, and we had an essay writing competition and I won it. And the reward from the English teacher was to take me to see Leeds Grand Theatre, Monty Python live on one of the rare live shows they ever did. And my mum had never let me watch Monty Python on television. She was so middle class and terrified of this anarchic, surrealistic, edgy comedy show. And suddenly she couldn't turn down that what took the award that I was given by my English teacher, age 12, you know. And so he took me to see Monty Python live.
So this is like early 80s, I'm guessing, something like that.
This was, 72.
Oh, wow. The farewell tour was 72.
Mm-hmm. Must have been. Okay. I mean, 72, yeah. 3. Might have been 13, might have been 11. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's amazing. To me, that is the whole thrill.
It was like a revelation. It was like, wow, what is this? It was life outside the middle class cocoon and the safety of the world that I was brought up in, and the kind of boredom and blandness, beige of the world I was brought up in. And I had a few experiences like that at the theater that opened my eyes.
Yeah.
And then obviously with books later, when I could get hold of the ones that had all been banned or taken to court at various times, or, you know, the weird ones.
But were you thinking as a teenager, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Any clue at all?
No. I had an aptitude for writing, I think, by the time I was about 15 or 16, when we did one of those careers testing thing, they said I should be a journalist. and that was about it, really.
Yeah.
No, I really hadn't a clue. It was very much, I was in deserts of culture, both at boarding school and at home. And so when something big happened, it was like Saul on the road to Damascus becoming Paul. I mean, they were such huge experiences. I took a school party to see Iggy Pop at Manchester Apollo with a friend, and I was 16, and it was like, this was the most real and dangerous thing I'd ever seen. And just, he was covered in blood, and it's coming fighting the bouncers, and beautiful. And it was just like, what is this? Hearing Paddy Smith's Horses and just going, you know, on the night I thought my father was going to die, and hearing it at like 11 o'clock at night with headphones, and hearing the song that opens with his father died and left him all alone on that New England farm. All the long black funeral cars left the scene, and the boy was just standing there. It was as if someone had spread butter on all the fine points of the stars, because when he looked up, they started to slip. And hearing those lines and hearing her improvise an 11-minute song about a boy losing his father. Those moments, I think, were shocking change moments, transformation moments.
And such a departure from what you had known. And that's what's interesting to me is that I think somebody who grows up in a desert of culture either manifests that themselves and never has culture themselves, or has those shocking moments and completely goes the opposite direction into the arts. Mm-hmm. Did you know you had any kind of aptitude for singing?
No. I sang in the choir 11, 12. Then the next school, if you were in the choir, you got bullied. So I purposely failed the test. And you had to, you missed lots of sports and stuff. And I quite enjoyed sports. So I didn't sing from 12 till 19 when James approached me and to dance for them. They saw me dancing in a bar and asked me to dance for their band. And then they asked me to sing backing vocals. I was like, okay, I was better than the singer they had. They fired her about 4 months later and instituted me as the main singer.
And then, so now you're the lead singer of James at a very young age, and you probably don't have any clue of like, where is this going to take me? You probably couldn't imagine you would still be the lead singer of James, in 2024. But how did it transition to you becoming the lyricist? Did they have a lyricist at the time?
No, they were very random. They'd often cut up newspaper articles into like phrases and sing them and
then like a hostage letter.
They were 16, and their lyrics were terrible. And when they got rid of the singer and they said, you're singing, and they had a gig in a week's time, I said, well, I'm not singing your lyrics. And they were like, well, write your own. They had one song. I have a way with girls, me being so good looking. I have a fantasy. I want to be raped by a woman. That was one of their most notable lyrics. So I was in a frantic rush before the first gig to rewrite quite a few of the lyrics.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the first lyric I wrote was called What's the World? And about 3-4 years later, the Smiths covered it as the only song they ever covered of anybody else outside the Smiths.
Oh, wow.
And they covered our song What's the World, which is the first lyric I ever wrote. Morrissey, like, I was at his house and he was like, will you tell me the lyrics? I can't quite decipher them. And I would say them out loud to him and his eyebrow would arch as he suddenly realized what he was about to sing. But he went ahead and did it. So it was pretty cool.
That's amazing. Did you?
Yeah.
So when you approach, I am just curious about your, over the decades, as you approach sitting down to write, and forgive me if this is something that's been asked of you a million times. Are you writing without music and the music comes later, or are you just letting things come to you?
Improvising with the band and then kind of singing nonsense words, makeup sounds and real words combination, recording it and then going back and hearing the genesis of the lyric starting and going, oh, that's what this song seems to be about. Very much. I'm a flow baby. I kind of listen to the jams and it's very much a feeling of what does this song want to be about? Mm-hmm. I never really try to impose too much, but there's usually something in that first jam that suggests to me where it's going. And I follow that. And then start writing, at home separately with the track and try out.
Right. So you don't write ever without the music. You don't have an inspiration for lyrics necessarily that come to you. That's so fascinating.
None of us bring anything in. We all, four of us, go in a room with a drum machine, hit play, do 6 hours a day, making a racket and record it all and then make the songs from there.
Wow. And then you write the lyrics and then you were kind of mentioning about editing. Are you constantly editing the lyrics to your song? I mean, I'm sure even when you're performing live, you might improvise. Is that something that happens quite a bit?
Yeah. Now, I think the editing took longer to come by. The first ones were probably less edited, but now, I've got files of, each song, there'll be 30 pages of different attempts at lyrics and editing and whittling it down, getting it perfect. Then you come to sing it, and there's some bits you find difficulty singing, and you just know that there's something wrong with the lyric, that's why you're tripping up. And then then you get the lyric right. So yeah, it's a constant process. Used to be very quick for me. Now it's about 6 months to do an album.
Fast to do an album.
Yeah, I think so. But when we did Laid with Brian Eno producing, I was writing tracks in the studio. We were jamming a lot of songs and I was writing lyrics. And I'd bump into Peter Gabriel and I'd say, "How are you doing, Peter?" And he'd be like, "Oh, I've been doing this album and taking me 2 years to write the words." And, and he'd go, "How are you doing?" And I'd go, "Oh, pretty good." And he'd ask me what I'd done. And I'd say, "Well, I wrote two lyrics today." And he'd be a bit like pissed off with me, I think. It was just a different way of, and now I take much more time over the things. But then I was a bit more like, I liked spontaneity.
Yeah. So, and that's what's interesting to me, the differences between, writing lyrics, writing poetry, for example, and writing novels. I've talked to a lot of poets on the show as well, and a lot of their work is very personal and it's very, obtuse to the outside observer. And they don't really necessarily care that you understand what the poem is about. I think a lot of lyricists are that way as well. It's very personal and this is my story, whatever it is. Then you get into a novel and you have to be clear in a way. I'm just curious to know kind of your approach when you started writing a novel, how much of that free form it took over versus how much of like, okay, I really need to structure this. I need to get feedback, all the things that perhaps you're not used to doing with songwriting.
I took 10 years writing this novel and I did it in between James' albums. We made so many records in that time period too. And I took 10 years learning how to write a novel. Mm-hmm. I was in a writing class, good writing classes in LA that gave me the foolish notion that I could write a novel. And I loved those classes. They were typical LA. There'll be famous people walk in and, unbalance the whole room and read stuff. And there'll be old poets in the corner and there'll be complete beginners all in the same room. And you get up and you read 2 minutes. And so I would get to read bits of what I was writing. And I could see I could hold people in individual scenes. What I didn't know is how on earth do you hold people for hours? Mm-hmm. How on earth do you give them, I know it instinctively in a song, but, our longest song is probably 9 minutes long. And I know how to do that. I've got a complete intrinsic built-in radar about form and you can feel when you're losing an audience. So mm-hmm. you cut something.
Right.
But here was a different skill. For years, I had no idea if it was any good. I knew that some of the scenes were really good, but I didn't know if the whole thing was going to hold.
Right.
And I had somebody else was writing a novel called Bonnie Solomon. And so we would meet up every week for a year or two and read to each other what we got. That was really helpful. And then I got to a point about 6 years ago where I started showing it to people and letting people read it. And at first I'd be deeply apologetic. But I sent it to one editor and he wrote back going, "It's pretty good." I'd kind of send it to a publisher. This is 5-6 years ago. I didn't heed his advice. I wanted it much better before I went near anyone like that.
Yeah.
So, and then I've had lots of beta readers at various stages where I really valued that process was so important to me, to send it out to people, to ask them where they got lost, what they loved, what they didn't love. And so at various stages, I've turned to friends for that advice. And that's been massively important to me.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about holding somebody, holding the reader. It's, and with a novel, you don't have, you know, you learn you don't have to hold them the whole, or you hold them differently throughout different parts of it. Because the idea of like you're writing a thriller that you have to be tense all the time is you're going to destroy your reader. But I do think that kind of comes over time. But your time existed over a 10-year period, so you taught yourself. And I'm curious to know what was the impetus for it? Like, did you always want to write a novel, or what was, or you just had an idea? I'm like, I have to create this.
I'd written a few screenplays, got optioned. And that was probably 20 years ago. And I was kind of curious about that. Like, one was really quite good and got optioned and looked like it was going to get made and then didn't get made. The novel impetus was a very particular moment, which doesn't appear in the novel anymore. But the impetus came from Kate's grandmother, my wife's grandmother. When I first started dating her, wouldn't meet me because I wasn't Jewish. And she was furious that Kate was dating a non-Jew. And I went to the house one day and Kate's mum said, oh, she's upstairs. She was in the 90s, you know, take her a cup of tea. And I went upstairs. And this very bird-like creature that everyone in the family was terrified of was there with Kate. And I brought her a cup of tea. And after 2 minutes, she started to look at me. And she was like, you're a singer, aren't you? I was like, yeah. Sing me a song. I haven't got an instrument. Sing me a song. So I sang her this song and I put everything into it. It was very much a spell, a wooing song that I have used to seduce in a like, it's called Please Fall in Love with Me. And I sang it from every part of me, and Kate was crying. And the grandmother looked at me at the end of the song and she said, that's very nice. And I can imagine the girls really like you. But let me tell you, if you hurt my Kate, I will come back from the dead and I will haunt you. If you hurt my Kate, I will come back from the dead and I will haunt you. And I came out of that going to, I said to Kate, wow, wouldn't that be a great plot that like this kind of addicted singer who can't help himself loves this girl and he gets haunted by this kind of very ferocious, very damaged grandmother from another century, really. That was the initial impulse. I wrote that scene first. And then she never ended up in the book. She ended up becoming the mother. Does haunt him. There is a haunting in the book. And he's very much, the book is very much, he's very haunted by his past, as most of us are in some way or another. That scene never made it in.
So was your 10-year journey writing this book? I mean, that's
probably
a long
longer.
Time. Yeah,
probably longer. Quite frankly, that initial meeting was 28 years ago.
Oh wow! Okay. So was it there? There must be a degree of tenacity in there too. Of like, I am going to do this. I don't care how long it takes because I want it. I want to see if I can do this. How much of there of that was there? Versus I just need the time to develop enough in novel writing to get to the finish line.
Both. Yeah. I'm a very tenacious human being.
I believe that.
40 years in a band. there was one point for a year and a half where I couldn't write anything. I just couldn't write anything. And I thought, God damn, I'm going to lose this book. It was probably 800 pages long at that point.
Oh my God.
I mean, I'd probably written 1,500 pages altogether, but at that point it was quite long. And I was like, I can't. And I couldn't write. And then it came, and then after a year and a half, I managed to get back into it. There was a determination at that point of like, I'm not letting this go to waste. I know there's some good stuff here. I just need to weed it out. You know, all the time I'd be like reading all the books by writers about writing books and taking courses and learning about editing. I had a great editing coach in LA, Josh Grapes, who did some amazing courses that I worked on that I just thought this was amazing. Editing was a revelation, really, working with him. Mm. And then it just got like, you know, I'm not giving up on this thing. But the truth is, I didn't know it held together until about maybe a few months ago. Because every time I'd read it, I'd see the mistakes and I'd see what I could improve. So all I'd see is flaws that needed working on. And then in the last few months, when the publishers kept making me read it and read it again and for the proof copies, etc., I started to go, this is really good. this is working. And then I handed it out to a few of the last readers and they were like, I was up all night reading it till 4 a.m. and I was like, okay, this is really working. But it took me that long to believe in it. But it took me 7 years to believe I was a decent singer. It took me, you know, even though I sang for 7 years with the band, it was about seventh year that I began to go, okay, I've got quite a good voice.
Yeah. That's interesting because usually by the point you're at right now with this book, you know, for me, I hate my book at that point. I don't want to see it again. I think it's terrible. Mm. And I just release it to the wild and just learn to let go. Because imposter syndrome lives deeply in the writing community. You know, it wasn't until my fourth book was published that I'm like, okay, maybe I know what I'm doing. But I still have hesitations about all of it. But I will tell you, so you sent me a copy of this a few days ago and I'm like, oh, I'm not going to have time to like read the whole thing, but I will definitely read some. And so I started reading, I'm like, holy shit. And I'm not just kissing your ass here. I was like, I was kind of floored by it. The writing is so the word frenetic comes to my mind. It's kind of this orchestrated chaos that is so beautifully done and, you know, so transporting that I can just visualize all of it. And I was not that I was surprised that it was that good. But it was pretty amazing. So well done from my perspective, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it. But I can only imagine how much editing went into it to get, because the pacing is what struck me as very on point, in a way that carries you through, even if maybe there's not much happening in the moment. You just like, I want to know more and more and more. And clearly it's a very personal journey, kind of hidden behind a fictional character. It seems to me you've kind of gone that Princess Bride route where you're like, well, this isn't my book. This is somebody else's book that I've inherited, basically, which I love that. I love that conceit. And I love the idea that you shit on the prologue that then is followed by a prologue. I think that's wonderful.
There's a lot of humor in the book and that I had to work on, I think. But I'm really proud of it now, but it, as I say, it took a lot of crafting. Here's the difference. You see, when you started your first book, you didn't have an audience. You knew you were putting out into the wild and you would get the forgiveness of a first time author. I was like, I won't get forgiven of the first time author because I've got an audience and people will come and buy it. So I've got to hit the ground running. Right. So, you know, if I'd released it 2 years ago, it would have read more like a first time, like my first book or something. I had to make it so that it felt like it can really hold the audience that will come and inquisitively take a look at it.
Right.
Because I figured I wouldn't get a second chance.
And so, but I think that's, I mean, and you, so you sold it to Little Brown, which is amazing. That's a fan, obviously a fantastic publisher. And I'm sure Little Brown, in addition to recognizing the quality of the writing and how compelling the story is, also knew, to your point, hey, this guy's got an audience. That's very helpful. So I'm sure there that was a consideration on their part as well, as like, you know, this is going to be a popular book. Thank God it's a good book.
Oh, sorry, you froze then. I missed all that.
Oh, I was just saying that Little Brown probably very much recognized, in addition to being a quality book, knew that you had an audience. And that's definitely compelling for them as a publisher to put it out into the world, knowing that it, you know, it's going to sell well. Plus, it's a quality book.
Thank you. Well, yeah, HarperCollins and Little Brown both wanted it, and I wanted to work with somebody who would really let me. Basically, I said I want to read the whole book to an editor, and so I want an editor to like who will sit with me with that.
Oh, wow.
I wanted somebody I like being in the room with. And they let me do that. So I went with Little Brown on that basis, and lovely editor, Andreas Campanar, who was kind enough to sit while I read him the whole book. And I'd watch, like, I knew when I was losing him because his eyebrow would arch, or I knew that when my sentences were trying to stuff too many things into the sentence. Or, you know, what I realized was the first time I wrote the book, I wrote it purely for me. So I would go, Carter sits there with a frown on his head and wearing his Sony headphones, nodding. You know, his beard is partially black, partially gray. I describe the books. I describe the thing in the background, everything. Yeah. And then you finally start reading it to an editor or someone else. And they're like, why am I listening to this amount of detail? Well, I want to know what the character's going to fucking do. And there were some bits I really loved of that. Like there's a movie, Don't Look Now. It's one of my favorite ever movies by Nicholas Rogue. And the characters will be talking and the camera will go off the characters and be watching people in the street fighting or having an argument. And I loved that. It was like, oh my God, it's like, this is really how the brain works. We're so distracted all the time that we do get taken out of the moment. And so I had quite a lot of moments of that where there'd be major scenes and then there'd be something going on in the background that he keeps fixating on. But there were too many of those. They were packed through the whole novel. It was almost like the thematic, the kind of background theme to the whole novel. And I took a lot of those out.
Right, right. And you start to realize how movies can afford to visually give you information that can't be done through the written word or the screenplay, which when you write a novel, like to your point, you've got to take so much of that out because it's information, but it slows everything down. I'm curious to know, like, why was it important to you? Because it's fascinating to me to read the book to an editor. I've never heard of that, and I can't think of anything more horrifying for as an author to do that.
I'm a performer, and that's to true. Get to really, I need to, like, when we're making songs, we often take them on the road before they're ready and try them out on an audience, and you can feel which ones are going to fly and which ones are going to hit the ground. And so it gave me that opportunity to see if the whole narration ebbed and flowed and held together. Otherwise, I was too in my own head. I needed some sounding board to be able to like to witness that and go, okay, this bit's too slow. This bit's too much exposition. This bit, you know, how do I get through this? How can I cut that? And it was just incredibly, it was the most important thing for me. And it will be insisted if I do another one, which I think I will. I think I know where Seth Brakes, who's the lead character. I think I know where he is right now. When I do another one, that will be another insistence with whoever I sign a deal with that somebody's, or some poor soul sits in the room with me for a number of weeks and lets me read it to them.
And you bring up an interesting topic, the idea of you know, what now? And I know for a lot of debut novelists, for example, who don't have a built-in audience, nobody's interested unless you have, okay, what else do you have? That's the very common publisher question. I'm sure you're probably afforded more of, this is amazing. If you want to write another one, fantastic. But we also understand this isn't necessarily your day job. But you just mentioned that you might have an idea for Seth as an appendum to what you've just written. Is that something that is, you know, I can't wait to do another novel. I'm not going to take 10, 12 years this time, or it's just like, well, we'll see what happens.
I've got a couple of things, brewing, but I'm going to wait a little bit. I literally handed in the final completed thanks everything last Friday.
Okay.
So these are my first days of freedom. So I think I need to celebrate a little longer first.
Yeah.
Before I start writing.
Well, plus you're touring, you've got an album coming. I mean, you've got other stuff going on in your life.
I got an album coming out next week.
When is the book officially coming out? Because I saw a couple different dates online.
A month later. It's coming out on May the 16th in this country. It's going to come out later in America. I'm looking to tour in America later in the year. So we might coincide it with a tour so I can actually do some readings or some events. Yeah.
Well, if you come to Denver, I would love to host you at like the Tattered Cover or something and interview you in front of an audience. I do a lot of that and I love doing it. So,
lovely.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I'll put this in the intro. When I first saw James live, it was in Denver and my friend got us tickets and then she bailed at the last second. And so I almost didn't go because it's a long drive for me. And I went, and that was my transformation. I saw you live alone, and I'm like, holy shit, I just had some kind of moment. And I've been, that was probably 17 years ago. And I grew up in LA. I knew, I was listening to K-Rock all the time. But that concert, and then that necessitated me flying to Dublin from Denver alone just for 2 days to see James. And that was an amazing moment as well. So that was me fanboying out for a second there.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's lovely. Yeah, that Dublin concert. Did I ever tell you the story of that Dublin concert?
No.
So we arrived at the venue and somebody said, oh, the U2 boys have left you a message. And they handed me an envelope. And I was focused on the gig and I didn't open it. And I did the gig. If it's the same one, I climbed the speaker stacks and walked on the balcony in the circle. Mm-hmm. Is that the same gig? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was like two boxes, you know, posh boxes, and I couldn't see in because they were dark, but I sang into one of them as I climbed the speaker stacks and I got across the balcony and climbed down the other side. And when I got back to my hotel room at about 11:30, I thought, oh, that letter. And I opened it up and it was from Bono saying, I'm going to be at the gig and it's a friend's birthday. I'm bringing her for her birthday. And would you dedicate some times to her? And I hadn't seen, of course, you know, this letter until afterwards. And so I rang him up that night and he was like, oh no, we had a great time. You sang into our box. You know, you when you climbed the speakers, you sang into our box.
Oh, perfect.
It was perfect. You know,
and you never saw him though. You didn't know he was there.
I never saw him. I didn't know he was there.
That's wonderful. Well, Tim, yeah. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, we're going to do a quick storytelling because this is the making it up portion of the show where I've picked three books, not totally at random, because I had you in mind a little bit. And you're going to choose one of these books and we're going to choose a random sentence from a random page. I'm going to read that sentence. And then that's the first sentence and maybe a 2 minute long short story. So I'll read the sentence. You give me the next one or two sentences of what maybe happens. So it's very improv-y, very yes and kind of a situation. But funny enough, I do have David Mitchell's Slate House, which is probably his most accessible book.
it's one of the ones I least like, I have to say.
Okay, but probably because it's so accessible.
Well, no, it's just Cloud Atlas is to my mind, the greatest book I've ever read. And but he has a very accessible book called Black Swan Green, which is beautiful, coming of age story, probably him, but fictional as well. Which I think that try that one. That would that's so beautiful and
elegant. I'll try that one. Thank you for the recommendation. I also have Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, and my buddy S.A. Cosby, All the Sinners Bleed. So choose one of those books.
I'll go for Mitchell. I can't help it.
Okay. Even though it's your one of your least favorites. And give me a page between 1 and 250.
59.
Okay. So I'm just going to quickly find a sentence here. Oh, this is, you can do whatever you want with this. So I'm going to read it out. I get to work with the knife.
Slowly whittling away the wooden bark, the bark, removing the pulp, shaping the gun.
It had to look real. In fact, if it didn't look real, I would likely be dead within 24 hours. It was a lot of pressure to put on me. But after all, I had to save her.
I cut myself. Blood pulled out onto the barrel. I licked it off. It tasted good.
Funny how the salty taste of blood can remind someone when they haven't eaten for over 16 hours. But there wasn't time for that now. I could hear the internal metronome of the remainder of my life running out inside my head. If I had to bleed to get to where I needed to go, I was okay with that.
The drugs were kicking in. My vision was distorting. I knew that some of the time release capsules were coming to their overloaded state.
Oh, I think we call it there. That was lovely. It's very visceral.
It's very visceral.
I do that every time and it's always scary. But it's, I love the idea that whatever you think you're going to say, you might have to change it because the other person goes and takes it into a different direction. I love accepting that premise and then pivoting. It's kind of like figuring out lyrics while you're jamming.
Yeah, fun.
Well, Tim, so great to see your face and to get a chance to sit down and talk with you some more. And congratulations on your wonderful book. I will make sure to sing its praises to anyone listening to me, and really congratulations.
Read it first. Good to see you. Are you good? Is everything going? Have you got something out right now?
Yeah, my ninth book just came out last Tuesday. A week ago. Wow. And then my 10th comes out in January.
You are just a one-man machine. How do you
I love
this?
It.
Are you,
I love it.
Are you just still doing it after work, or are you sitting and working each day?
So I don't work at that job anymore. So I'm pretty much writing full time, but I only write an hour a day. But I spend the rest of the time, social media, marketing, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we're designing online courses right now. So I'm doing coaching and running writing retreats. So just really diving in.
Which of your books really broke through and took you to another level?
Probably Mr. Tender's Girl. That might be the first one with James lyrics in it, coincidentally. but none of them have been like this amazing, like millions of copies breakthrough, but you just kind of chip away at it and you grow your name and you get out there and you network and you build an audience over time. So it's been great. And I learn new stuff with every book. So it's always exciting to me.
I shape the book like a thriller to some degree. I wanted it to be a page turner.
Yeah,
so
it is.
I was saying, you know, it's like, how do you tell this story and make people really want to turn the page?
Right.
Because, you know, there's nothing worse, I think, than, you know, if you get 30 pages in a book that don't turn you on, the book's gone.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. Totally. And I think by deleting all of those descriptions is exactly how you most best, the best way to write a thriller is to write a non-thriller and then just cut and it's, and leave in the stuff that is propulsive. You know, and I think from what I've read of yours, that's what you've achieved.
So when you do an hour a day, wow, you just don't let yourself write more than that or.
Yeah, pretty much not. But I do it 7 days a week. So if I'm actively writing a draft, then my goal is 500 words. And that might take me 20 minutes. But because I don't outline, you know, 40 minutes is spent thinking about what comes next and or writing and deleting and then writing again. But once that hour's up, I'm done. But that's a full manuscript, 85,000 words in like 10 months. So I'm a book a year kind of a person. So it's not that hard, but it took me 20 years to get to that level.
And the rewriting?
Yeah, that includes rewriting. I probably do 2 rewrites before I give it to my agent and then rewrites based on her. And then after we sell it, it can be months of rewriting after that, depending on what my editor thinks. And usually I'm in something new at that point. So I have to take a few months off and go back to this book. So that's all kind of baked into it. So, but it's, I do it because I love it. You know, I can't imagine not doing it. So, you know, but it took me a long time to get to the level where I feel like I found my voice.
Great. Well done.
So, yeah.
Well done.
Well, let me know if you're going to be in Denver. I would love to host you. And again, congratulations, not only on the book, but the album and all your continued success, Tim.
I reckon Denver in October.
Oh, I will be here.
Okay.
Wonderful. All right. Let me know. Thanks, Tim. I appreciate your time. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
So that's it. That is my conversation with Tim Booth. So that was an interview years in the making, and I'm excited that it finally happened. I think it went great. He was all game with the making it up portion of the show, and I thought that story was highly compelling. So a win all around, I would say. Tim's new book is When I Died for the First Time, and it is out in the UK on May 16th, probably hopefully coinciding with the drop of this episode. And, you know, be sure to check that out. And if you want to check out James, the band, which is the greatest band of all time, in my opinion, you can just go to wearejames.com and they have a new album out right now. So that's it. That is it for this monumental episode of Making It Up. More episodes will be out next week. In the meantime, of course, friends, thank you so much for always listening and or watching, and take care.